Okay, so we have been talking about the faith of an atheist and going through for the last couple of months the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Of course, we had some other stuff stuck in here as well. But and so we've looked at all of the arguments from a as far as the universe, as far as life, as far as truth and morality to prove the existence of God. So then what we're starting now, and we broached it a little bit last week when we talked about miracles, is, okay, now which God, right? Okay, and so obviously the Bible and more importantly the New Testament tell the story about Jesus, right? Jesus the Messiah came to save us, the Son of God, right? So when looking at the New Testament, how do we know if it's true? Because as we established at the beginning, there is truth. So it's either right or it's wrong. One of the two, can't be both. So there is truth. We need to know what that truth is. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So I was telling JT about this, JT, earlier. So this becomes a complicated part to teach, because so much of it is reading. Like, in other words, you know, comparing, looking at stories in Scripture and things like that, right? So I'm not going to be able to give you guys probably the full picture from here on out. I would just strongly suggest, if you haven't read this book, that you get it and you read it, okay? But I'm going to do my best. Fair enough? Okay. So, so now we're talking about early testimony about Jesus. So one of the arguments or rebuttals that you're going to run into when talking about the Bible, especially the New Testament, well, it was written well after Jesus was here. It couldn't have been written by anyone who actually saw Jesus or was with Jesus. This is just... Heck, did Jesus even exist? This stuff's just made up later, okay? Well, this addresses a lot of that. So, all right, so the gospel, I'm going to read this. The gospel according to non-Christians. In AD 66, Jews in Palestine initiated a revolt against the Roman rule that the Romans did not appreciate. The emperor sent troops led by General Vespasian to quash the rebellion and regain control of rebel areas. In 67, Vespasian laid siege to the rebel town of Jotapata in Galilee. In the 47th day of that siege, a young revolutionary chose to surrender to the superior Roman army rather than commit suicide, a fate that many of his countrymen had chosen. That young man won favor with Vespasian and was later taken to Rome by General Titus, Vespasian's son, after Titus destroyed Jerusalem and the Jewish temple in 70. That young man was Flavius Josephus, who ultimately became the greatest Jewish historian of the time. He began his historical writings in Rome while serving as a historian for the Roman Emperor Domitian. It was there that he authored his autobiography and two major historical works. One of those is his now famous Antiquities of the Jews, which was finished in about AD 93. In book 18, chapter 3, section 3 of that work, Josephus, who was not a Christian, wrote, "At this time, the time of Pilate, there was a wise man called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die, but those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders." And this wasn't Josephus's only mention of Jesus. In another passage in the same book, he revealed how the high priest of the Jews took advantage of a gap in Roman rule to kill James, the brother of Jesus, in AD 62. And I'm not going to read that. But so you guys have to remember, think about the life of Jesus, right? So born at zero, right? Died roughly 33 AD, okay? Rose, right? Okay. So we're talking between 33 AD And when he wrote this in, 93 AD? So in a 60-year window, that story was already established and well-known by historians. Does that make sense? So the whole, especially you see it a lot on social media, TikTok, this whole thing, well, did Jesus even exist? Really? So it was already confirmed in the same century by historians that Jesus existed, okay? So so you've got a first century reference to Jesus and confirmation that his brother James existed as well. Now, how many non-Christian sources mention Jesus from that time period? So you've got, including Josephus, there are 10 known non-Christian writers who mention Jesus within 150 years of his life. By contrast, over that same time period, there are only 9 non-Christian sources who mention Caesar, the Roman emperor at the time of Jesus. So if you take away the Christian sources, Jesus is actually mentioned by one more source than the Roman emperor. And if you include the Christian authors, he's actually outnumbered 43 to 10. So there's another 33 authors, right, in the New Testament that mention Jesus. So the credibility for the existence of Jesus, pretty high, wouldn't you say? Okay. And so when we put together all of the non-Christian references, we could see that Jesus lived during the time of Tiberius Caesar. He lived a virtuous life. He was a wonder worker, had a brother named James, a claim to be the Messiah, crucified under Pontius Pilate, crucified on the eve of the Jewish Passover. Darkness and an earthquake occurred when he died. His disciples believe he rose from the dead. They were willing to die for that belief. Christianity spread rapidly as far as Rome, and his disciples denied the Roman gods and worshiped Jesus as God. All of those things are confirmed, historically accurate events. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So we have two main questions about the documents that comprise the New Testament. One, do we have accurate copies of the original documents as they were written? And two, do those documents speak the truth? Okay, so obviously you remember as a kid playing the game of telephone, right? Where one kid's given a message and by the time it gets to the end, it's something completely different. I'm convinced, by the way, that there were kids that like purposely changed it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like maybe there needs to be some incentive for the message to be the same at the end.
Yeah.
And then I think that game would have worked a lot more than it didn't, right?
I know I changed.
But, you know, you've got some, you've got some kid like Josh, right? And he's, you know, he's in there and he's changing words and changing the whole thing. And the carrier pigeon game. All right. So for sake of the recording, Josh accused Pastor of playing the carrier pigeon game when he was a kid because phones didn't exist. So, all right. So, but the New Testament was not transmitted that way. So the New Testament, keep in mind, is not one writing, but 27. So about 27 different documents on 27 different scrolls by 9 different writers over a 20 to 50 year period. And those writings have been collected into one book we now call the Bible. So the New Testament is not one source. It is a collection of many sources. So the only real problem is that we can say is we don't have any of the original documents, okay? We only have copies of the original writings called manuscripts. So does this prevent us from knowing what the original said? No, because most significant literature from the ancient world was reconstructed into its original form by comparing manuscripts that survive. But to reconstruct the original, you have to have a large number of manuscripts written not long after the original. And more manuscripts and earlier manuscripts provide a more trustworthy testimony and a more accurate reconstruction. So how does the New Testament compare in these areas? Well, we have nearly 5,800 handwritten Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. There are also some additional 20,000 manuscripts in other languages. Some of these are complete Bibles, other are books or pages, and some are just fragments. The next closest work is the Iliad by Homer with only 1,800 manuscripts. So there's almost three times as many actually, there's more than three times as many manuscripts for recreation of the New Testament than there is other books that right. nobody is questioning their credibility. Right. Early manuscripts, okay? So, okay. Manuscripts that are largely complete New Testament books survive from around AD 200. Most of the New Testament, including all the Gospels, survive from 250, and a vast majority survives from about 325. Now, most of those manuscripts have spelling and punctuation characteristics that suggest they're in a family of manuscripts that can be traced back to AD 100 and 150. Okay, so why does this matter? So it matters because the earlier that they're available and the more of them there are, it lends to the accuracy of those manuscripts compared to the original, right? So, because you're not, and it's in here somewhere. Where's this? Oh, yeah, it says right here. So why didn't God preserve the original? Okay. Well, so again, this is what was commonly done with manuscripts back then, okay? But let's say he did preserve the original, and that's all we had was the original. Who gets to control it? Who gets to keep it? Who gets to guard it? Who gets to say who gets to see it, right? Okay? So in other words, it actually would have been detrimental for there to have only been the original preserved. Does that make sense? Okay. So how are they reconstructed? We could take many copies and compare them. And so suppose we have four different manuscripts that have four different errors in one verse, such as basically one letter in one word is different in each of the four, right? So it gives the example, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. In the first one, the H is a different, in things is a different letter. In the second one, the I in things is a different letter. The fourth one, the N, and the fifth one, or the fourth, third one in the N, the fourth one, the G, right? And so a lot of people would look at that and go, oh, well, there's errors. Okay, well, you can look at it, and in context, you can figure out what it was saying, right? Because today we have typos, and we have autocorrect that fixes it. But when people are writing stuff down, sometimes they're going to transpose a letter or a word or something like that. Does that make sense? Okay, so accurate is the reconstruction. Some critics have said there are about 200,000 errors in the New Testament manuscript. First of all, they're not all errors, but variant readings, mostly strictly grammatical, like punctuation and spelling, like what I just said. And those are spread through 5,700 manuscripts. So the variant spelling one letter of one word in one verse in 2,000 manuscripts is called 2,000 errors. So in other words, if they see the one misspelling and they see it in thousands of manuscripts, then they count it as thousands of errors, yeah. Right? So that's how they get up to that ridiculous number. So even if you account for all of those, 98.33% of the text is 100% pure. And out of the 150,000 variants, only 400 changed the meaning of a passage, 50 were of any real significance, and not even one affected an article of faith or precept of duty, not abundantly sustained by other and undoubted passages, nor by the whole tenor of Scripture teaching. In other words, there's nothing in any of these supposed errors that discounts or contradicts or changes anything of what we believe. No other ancient book is so well authenticated. Even Iliad is only 95%. When you look at the New Testament, it's about 99.5%. And even that 0.5% does not change a single doctrine. So is the New Testament historically reliable? So we're not seeking at this point to decide whether it is without error or the Word of God, but is the basic storyline, in fact, true? Okay, so the way we figure that out is we say, do we have early testimony? Do we have eyewitness testimony? Do we have testimony from multiple independent eyewitness sources? Are they trustworthy? Do we have corroborating evidence from archaeology or other writers? Do we have any enemy attestation? In other words, if opponents admit that things eyewitnesses say are true, then it's probably true. Does the testimony contain events or details that are embarrassing to the author? Most people don't want to make themselves look bad, so they're not going to share those details unless they're true. All right, so the most recent argument against the reliability of New Testament documents is the assertion that history cannot be known. Ironically, this usually comes from people who say they know that everything came from nothing and we evolved from apes and all those wonderful things. So they're absolutely sure about that history, despite the fact that there are no eyewitnesses or really corroborating data for those events. And then they say that the resurrection of Jesus cannot be known, even though there are eyewitnesses and corroborating data. Okay, so you use that same process to determine that George Washington was the first president of the United States, that Lincoln was the 16th, that Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, that the Mets won the 69 World Series. So are we sure about those things, even though we didn't see them? Of course. Why? Because there were witnesses, there's data, right? There's information that backs that up. Okay, so some of the things they say, New Testament writers were biased. You can be biased and still be objective. Does that make sense? So you can have, and we talked about this with atheists, that they were biased against Christianity, but when they looked at it objectively, they became Christians, right? So you can have a bias and still be objective. So, but then one of them says, so the New Testament writers, they say, why did they suddenly convert from Judaism to believing that Jesus rose from the dead? And one of them said, because they wanted power over the people. And he said, well, what power did they gain by asserting that Jesus rose from the dead? The answer is none. In fact, instead of gaining power, they got exactly the opposite: submission, servitude, persecution, torture, and death. So what possible motive did they have to make up the resurrection if it was not true? None, right? So you also have to understand that the Jews who converted to Christianity, why would they do that to risk persecution, death, and perhaps eternal damnation to start something that wasn't true and elevated non-Jews into the exclusive relationship they claimed to have with the creator of the universe? And why would they almost immediately, after a resurrection that didn't happen, stop observing the Sabbath, circumcision, the law of Moses, the centrality of the temple, the priestly system, and other Old Testament teachings, things that they had believed and practiced for nearly 2,000 years? So then it says, well, were the New Testament documents early? All New Testament books were written before A.D. 100. Which would be about 70 years after the death of Jesus. Okay, but most of them were written before AD 70, about 40 years. So imagine this. You're a devout Jew in the first century. The center of your national, economic, religious life is Jerusalem, and especially the temple. It has been that way in your nation, your family, and almost every Jew's family for 1,000 years, ever since Solomon built the first temple. Most of the newest temple, constructed by Herod, was completed when you were a child, but portions of it are still under construction and have been since 19 BC. For your entire life, you have attended services, brought sacrifices there to atone for the sins you've committed against God. Why? Because you and your countrymen consider the temple the earthly dwelling place of God, the maker of heaven and earth, the very deity whose name is so holy you don't dare to utter it. As a young man, you begin following a Jew named Jesus. Claims to be the long-awaited Messiah, predicting your scriptures. He performs miracles, teaches profound truth, scolds and befuddles the priests in charge of the temple, incredibly predicts his own death and resurrection, and predicts the temple itself will be destroyed before your generation passes away. Jesus is convicted of blasphemy by your temple priest, crucified on the eve of the Passover, one of your holiest holidays, buried in a Jewish tomb. 3 days later, you and other followers see Jesus alive just as he predicted. You touch him, eat with him. He continues to perform miracles, the last being his ascension. 40 years later, your temple is destroyed just as Jesus predicted, along with the entire city and thousands of your countrymen. Okay, so here's the question. If you and your fellow followers write accounts of Jesus after the temple and the city were destroyed in AD 70, aren't you going to at least mention that unprecedented national, human, economic, and religious tragedy somewhere in your writings, especially because Jesus predicted it? Of course. Well, the problem for those who say the New Testament was written later is there's absolutely no mention of the fulfillment of this predicted tragedy anywhere in the New Testament documents, which means that almost all, if not all, of the New Testament had to be written before 70 or they would have mentioned it.
Right.
Now, some may say that's an argument from silence. It doesn't prove anything, but it's not an argument from silence because the New Testament documents talk about Jerusalem and the temple, activities associated with them, as if they were still intact at the time of the writings. And even if it was from silence, it doesn't mean it's wrong. For example, if you have somebody that wrote this amazing book is about how amazing the Titanic was and how splendid it is and how it's the greatest ship ever, and it doesn't mention the tragic accident and sinking and all of that, you're going to know the book was written before that happened, mm-hmm. right? Because why would they write an entire book about the Titanic and not mention
right.
what happened to it? Does that make sense? Okay. So, now, many New Testament books were composed before AD 62, so about 30 years after the death of Jesus. So, and this is going through talking about Luke, right? So he's describing events, he's interviewing witnesses, he's talking about Paul, traveling with Paul, things like that. And then it says, since you obviously find it important to record all these minor details of your main subject, the Apostle Paul was executed at the hands of the Roman emperor, do you think you would record it? Or if Jesus' brother was killed at the hands of the Sanhedrin, do you think you would record it? Of course. And if you failed to record such momentous events, we would assume rightly that you wrote your narrative before their deaths. So the reason all this is important is because, again, you're dismantling the argument of, well, a bunch of people just wrote this stuff later.
Yeah.
Couldn't have been eyewitnesses, couldn't have been there, couldn't have seen what happened. That's just not true.
Yeah.
Okay? And then Mark, so I can go through all this, but Mark was probably written by the mid to late 50s, if not earlier. Some of them were in the 40s and 50s, and the sources from the 30s, which would be right around when Jesus died. And so, again, I can't go through all this. I'm already running out of time. So why not earlier? So this is, I really like this. So the skeptic says, okay, why not earlier? That's not early enough. I wouldn't wait 15 to 20 years to write it down if I saw this. Well, okay. In the New Testament times, a lot of the people were illiterate. So there was no real need initially to write it all down. It's mainly an oral culture, which, funny, we talk about the telephone game. But that's how it was. A lot of it, tradition was passed down, right, orally. So there weren't a whole lot of writings. Also, a lot of the New Testament writers may have hoped Jesus was coming back in their lifetime, so they saw no immediate need to write it down. But then third, as Christianity spread all over the world, writing became the most efficient way to communicate with the rapidly expanding church. So in other words, time and distance forced them to write it down. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah, there wasn't anybody to write to. They're all there, right? Now, it says, if Jesus actually did rise the dead, shouldn't there be more written about him than there is? Well, again, there were more writers about him than the Roman emperor at the time. 9 of these authors were eyewitnesses of the events, and they wrote 27 documents, the majority of which mention or imply the resurrection. That's more than enough to establish historicity. Yeah, historicity. Is that a word? I like that word. I didn't make that up. I read it. So, based on all of this and more that I did not read, we can conclude that we have an accurate copy of the original New Testament documents and that they are early and they contain even earlier source material. But then the question is, do they actually contain eyewitness evidence? I'm not going to have time to get into that. So, does anybody have any thoughts, questions, feedback, comments?
I was just going to say, I love that book, Frank Turek, and if memory serves, they can actually place Acts being written within 15 years of Jesus' death.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty good. One of the stories that that I like, or that Frank Turek tells, is about a friend of his who his daughter went to college, and she was gone for a couple of weeks. Called her dad and said, "Sorry, Dad, I don't believe in God anymore." So she got there. She was influenced almost immediately. The world got a hold of her, and she called her dad to let him know that she was no longer walking in Christ. And I was just going to say, props, best way to, this is a good lesson. Like, it's extremely important that our young people are armed with this kind of knowledge, okay? Because if you don't know whether or not the Bible was written, if it's accurate, how is it accurate? Why is it accurate? Why do we believe that it's accurate? If you don't know these things, you are easily influenced. And so, anyway, great message.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is, now you don't even have to go to college anymore, and it's not even in public school. It's in your social media. So your kids are seeing it all day, every day. I mean, you go on TikTok right now, and you have hundreds or even thousands of people that have live streams completely dedicated to discrediting Christianity. And you could jump on there, and this is, I talked about this at the beginning of my, when I kicked this off, is you could jump on there and watch for 30 minutes, an hour. And if you don't know what you know, I mean, there are probably many people in any church that if they sat and watched that for an hour, they'd start to question what they believe. Because these people are so well-versed in their arguments, and the people that get on and try to debate them really don't understand what they believe or why, and they make them look foolish. And if you sat there and watched that for an hour, you'd go, wow, am I really on the right side of this thing? Because there's, you don't have that understanding.
I have a couple things, but that's absolutely correct, because you've got so many gifted orators. I remember, I'm not going to name orators. Boy, everybody's a critic, ain't they? Orators, apparently.
Never criticize the man with the microphone.
Anyway, I'm not going to name names, but I remember listening to a speech from a politician one time and thinking, if I hadn't gone and looked and seen what their values and morals were and the way that the things they've supported, man, I'd be right on board with this dude. I mean, it's a gift. I remember when I was growing up, I saw somebody talk about that your religious beliefs weren't a product of what you actually believed, but of geography. And that bugged me. And so I went and started reading other things and studying other things as well as what I believed. And the simple fact is, and this is, I think, what is important to teach the next generation. We talk about it in the Wolfville all the time. I'm going to make a comparison and I'll shut up. Some of the best people I've ever worked for in the Wolfville don't know everything, but they know how to think things through and figure them out. Not asking you to believe in what I'm believing. I'm asking you to think and to research and to read and actually look at all the evidence. Not the first thing, like JT pointed out a while back. People love to have an opinion and, okay, I'm going to do some research on this. And the first thing that they find that supports their idea, it's settled. You need to teach the next generation to think, to use their heads. I'm not trying to keep you from studying other things. But I promise you, when you get into the meat and potatoes and the facts like this, I've listened to IQ geniuses where I'm going, that is the stupidest smart person I've ever listened to in my whole life. It doesn't even make sense. You can't make it make sense. I'm cut off, apparently. I'll move along.
But yeah, it's completely true, right? And so that's the whole point of this book and kind of what we're teaching is to understand what we believe, why we believe it. And that's why up until basically today, the Bible hasn't been used at all to establish any of these things. And even so, the Bible itself is not being used as the criteria by which we're authenticating and validating the Bible, right? We're using the same criteria that we would use for any other historical document to look at the Bible and go, okay, is it true, right? Because again, we've narrowed it down to basically three choices. There has to be a God, and it's one of three. So now we need to figure out why this one, the God of the Bible, is God. Does that make sense? And so obviously we're going to have to explore the Bible to do that, but before we do, we have to establish the credibility of the Bible. Then we can look at it and see what it says. Does that make sense? So, all right, cool. Appreciate you guys.